Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. Please turn your mobile phones off. The podcast is about to start. I'll bring in now Sylvester and Jason to get things underway.
Last chance. Let the hostages go, or you're out of there.
I'll take the four on the left.
Why don't you take the two on the right and leave the rest alone?
You should take the two on the right. You're not that fast anymore.
The only thing faster is light.
We'll see.
It's amazing
bullets
that they've been
faster,
willing to do this for me, and absolutely nothing could spoil their perfect intro.
Go get it. What's that?
In a text.
Bloody hell.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies. Movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
We would be honoured if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, title gives it away. I'm here to talk of the stories of film. And I tend to talk about development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all the bits and bobs, really, that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to choose for this podcast have more of a mainstream leaning to them than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree, certainly. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. I think there's lots of that around already. And I just really want to celebrate the fact that it's really hard to make a film. And I can't want to salute the people who've managed to do so. They've certainly done better than me in that regard. So without further ado, I'm going to crack on with the first of the two films I'm going to talk about in this episode. I'm going right the way back to 1989 to get things started. I'll play you a clip. The story comes the other side of this.
What could be taking them so long? I am not missing the mall today. Nick!
Ron?
You guys are hiding up here. It's not funny. Nick, you know what Dad said. You're not supposed to be playing up here.
God, what happened?
Amy!
Ross!
Amy!
Nikki.
Ron?
Nick, what happened?
We're all the size of boogers.
That then is a clip from 1989's Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, directed by Joe Johnston. Screenplay for this one by credited to Edna Hart and Tom Shulman, based on a story by Stuart Gordon, Brian Usner and Edna Hart. Cast led by Rick Moranis, of course, co-starring Matt Frewer, Marsha Strassman and Christine Sutherland. Now, the story of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, well, when you think of family entertainment, you don't necessarily think of the much-loved late director Stuart Gordon. His directorial CV, after all, I mean, you look at some of the highlights. 1985's Reanimator, based on the work of H.P. Lovecraft. I mean, that's not really family-friendly, is it? The Mighty Fortress, starring Christopher Lambert and the phrase Random Intestinations. If you've not had the pleasure of that film, do seek it out. Those are the kind of films I think he's more associated with. But towards the 1980s, he found himself working for Disney on a family feature. Now, in fairness, the idea for this one came from him, that after the release of Reanimator in 1985, as he told Digitally Obsessed in an interview, he said he was talking to his kids and they complained that they couldn't see his films, and understandably so. And so he thus came up with the idea for a project that they could watch. The idea of a bunch of kids being shrunk and ending up in the backyard and trying to stay alive whilst nature sort of had its way a little bit. And so he started developing this with his old friend Brian Usner. And this was picked up by a small production company called Doric Films. And they, in turn, would pass that project on to Disney. So we had this strange situation here of the director of Reanimator pitching to Disney the idea for a live-action family movie. Now, the person who's been pitched to was, I guess, a name that keeps coming up on these podcasts, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who is heading up, getting far more Disney live-action movies up and running in the 1980s. Certainly, he had a vision that Disney would have a new theatrical release once a week by the time that, early 1990s. He wasn't quite there at this point, but he'd been scoring some successes. Three Men and a Baby in 1987, that had gone on to be a huge hit. Sister Act was coming up around the corner as well. He was still looking to ramp up the output of more live action releases at this point, and he liked the idea for what Gordon was pitching, and the project thus went into development at Disney. So Gordon then got in touch with another old colleague, Edna Hart, to help with the screenplay for this one. He'd worked on a film called Dolls with Gordon in the past, and they started putting together a screenplay for a movie that was going under the name, at this stage, Teeny Weenies. Now, that name would change because it was deemed to be entirely child-centric, offering nothing for the grown-ups at all. But nonetheless, there was some momentum here that was going. And Nahar told the website Dr. Gore's Funhouse in an interview, he said they approached me about working with them and we came up with the story. And he said, when I was a kid on the East Coast, there was a comic strip in the Sunday edition of the New York Daily News called The Teeny Weenies. And he said it was one huge frame showing little people riding around on mice or sitting in thimbles. And I just loved that. There was also a little guy or girl that you could cut out of the newspaper and paste on cardboard to play with. So he said, in a way, I was prepared for this sort of thing ever since I could hold a newspaper in my hands. So they started putting this together. Now, things did evolve and change over time. Certainly the title for a start. I mean, Teeny Weenies wouldn't last too long. Grounded it became at one point. Then it was The Backyard. Then it was The Big Backyard. But in the midst of it all, as the screenplay was being written, with a view to Gordon directing, he would tell TCM that Disney still had nerves about, who knew, hiring the director of Reanimator to make a family project. And he said it was funny. Disney was very worried about it when we were working on it. He said they kept saying, we want this to be more like The Absent-Minded Professor and less like The Fly. And Gordon and Disney had a big row, for instance, over what the ants in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids should look like. Disney said to him, what is this ant going to look like? I said, well, it's going to look like an ant. They said, isn't that going to scare the kids? I said, what do you think it should look like? They said, well, we think it should have blue eyes and look sort of like E.T. And Gordon pointed out, well, E.T. scared more kids than an ant does. And in the end, what Gordon did is he took the executives down to the workshop where they were building a massive ant puppet for use in the movie. And they could see it with their own eyes. And he said, in a way, it's good that they think it's scary when they first see it. Then it turns out that it's not scary and it's nice. And so what happened then is the executives were down in the workshop and they brought over the puppeteer, and it said it had the ant come up and put its antenna over my shoulders and sort of nuzzled me like a horse would nuzzle somebody. Then all of a sudden it was okay and the Disney guys got it. But he admitted they were very concerned about that movie. Now, the mention of the ant goes to the level of practical work and craft that was put into the making of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, because those ants were, I mean, it's a physical construction. It did involve puppeteering. It did involve stop frame animation as well. And he said those ants were made out of foam. Loads and loads of foam was used in the creation of this. They also then covered the ants with horse's hair. Just to give a flavour of some of the practical stuff, there's a bit in the film where they end up in a huge bowl of Cheerios. And again, done practically, they coloured water to look like milk, and they made these huge Cheerios out of rubber tubes and decorated them all. They brought in David Allen to work on the stop motion work. The important thing here is they got a script together, but also the pre-production was going along really quite well. They weren't quite at the casting stage, but there was a view that, well, this film could get up and running by the autumn of 1987. They could potentially have it moving. But fate was to play a hand there, because fairly late in the day, the film hadn't started shooting, but Stuart Gordon fell ill. Ill to the point where he wasn't able to direct the movie. And he talked openly about this in interviews while he was still with us. And he talked about how he'd already storyboarded the movie, how he'd overseen the set designs of it, how basically the prep for the film was pretty much done. They got it to a place where it was ready to go. They had a script, that things were being built. But Gordon now was not able to do it, and he would take on a producing credit instead. So who was going to come in very, very late in the day to direct this movie? Well, Joe Johnston was not known for directing at this stage. He'd done a student film. That was the only thing that completed that he'd directed. That student film was seen, actually, by Jeffrey Katzenberg. But he was known for his visual effects and his craft work. He was part of the team that won an Oscar for Raiders of the Lost Ark, for instance. He'd worked on the Star Wars films with George Lucas. And he was recommended to Jeffrey Katzenberg, who in the end said he would hire him, quote, in spite of his student film and not because of him. Johnston had his big chance, and he would come in and he would make some changes to the film. He was a first-time director. He looked at the script, and ironically, for someone who dealt with so many effects, he thought the script in the state that he saw it was far too reliant on them. He wanted a bit more character in the film and a bit less of reliance on spectacle. And so he brought in the last credited writer on the movie, Tom Schulman, to do some work on the screenplay, just to repurpose it slightly. In the midst of all of this, the release date was moving. It had originally been intended that the film would be out for Christmas of 1988. It was clear that this was going to give a slight delay to the movie, and so Disney moved it to the summer of 1989 instead, the June of that year. A very fortuitous move, as we're going to come on to discuss. Now, from what I can work out of the chronology of this film, I've done quite a lot of reading, and there's a great big old article in an old Premiere magazine that I've dug through as well. The casting actually came together relatively late for this one, that a lot of the production work had already been, pre-production work had already been done. And there aren't massively contentious stories about how people like Matt Frewer, Marshall Strassman and Christine Sutherland came in, that the cast gradually came together. The only one where there was obvious to and fro that I've been able to find was in the starring role of Wayne Szalinski. So that role was originally intended, when they were putting the screenplay together, for Chevy Chase. Understandable. Big comedy star at the time. The National Lampoon's movies were big. Chase was good box office. But at this point, he had commitment to make National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. So he couldn't fit the film that was about to be called Honey, I Shrunk the Kids in. Next down the list, I mean, there are a couple of people considered, but next, the next one who really came into frame was John Candy. And John Candy, well, he looked at it and ultimately he would turn this one down. But it was he who suggested Rick Moranis, with whom he'd worked on Spaceballs, for the film. Now, Moranis at this stage, he hadn't led a movie, although 1989 would be the year that he had three films in the top 15 at the US box office. He was taking on supporting role in Parenthood, which I've covered before, and he was also part of the ensemble for Ghostbusters 2, which I've also covered before. But it took a call from Katzenberg to convince him to take the lead of this one. And as he would tell TCM, he said, one day the phone rang and it was him. Katzenberg. He told me about this movie and about the kind of film he wanted to do. He said, I read the script and looked at my kids. Well, at that time I had one kid and thought, what the heck? Moranis was on that was signing on the dotted line and the film was moving forward. It had its director in place, the cast was in place. And over in Mexico, the building of sets was underway. So that original plan was that the filming of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids would start in the autumn of 1987. This was put back to January of 1988 to accommodate the assorted changes that were being made and also the change in personnel as well. But Disney was a frugal studio, particularly frugal studio in the 1980s. And the limited budget of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids meant it was always going to be unlikely to shoot in Los Angeles or anywhere like that. And so instead, what they did was they went to Mexico and they went to the famous Churubusco Studios, where things like, I think, The Treasure of Sierra Madre was shot in and around there. And it turned out it was more economical to build an American neighborhood in the back lot of Churubusco Studios than it was to shoot this film in Hollywood. And it was an extensive set build that was being put together. There were several sets that needed to be done. This, whilst there was some green screen work that was done on Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, the vast bulk of what you're seeing is practically driven. So when you've got kids running around in the back garden, they built this enormous back garden. That was what was required for the film. You could imagine it would be done very differently today. So it would take the best part of a year to build all of the sets that they needed to make that film. And then by the start of 1988, the cast was off to Mexico to shoot the movie. And a long shoot it would be as well. It would also be a shoot, understandably, primarily contained within a studio complex. I gather there are little bits of pickup done in Los Angeles, and there's some location work that was done in and around Mexico City. However, the vast bulk of this film was shot on the backlot of Churubusco. And so, I mean, just to give an example of how difficult some of the effects challenges they were up against, just with the physicality of making the movie, that take that aforementioned ant. There were moments in the film where it took a dozen people just to operate it, to get the in-camera effect working. There was also, there's a moment with a bee. I'm going spoiler light on this. I can't help it. There was a moment with a bee that required a combination of techniques to bring together. It involved a $30,000 robotic bee to be built, a bit of green screen work, and then a giant model bee for some of the close-up shots for it. And it was testing for the production, and it was a lengthy shoot as well. But also, Moranis went into this very much with his eyes open, that he was aware of the challenges, and also he was conscious that he needed to stay fit and healthy for this one. And so, taking a lead for the first time in a big Hollywood movie, he drank bottled water, he would boil his fruit, he was careful not to get food poisoning or anything like that, and he knew he had to be front and center for a lot of it, even though he wasn't involved in, like, effectively the shrinking stuff, and some of the special effects stuff was really not involving him at all. He had to be sure he was right and ready. He was delighted. I am very thankful to Nick DeSemlin's book Wild and Crazy Guys, where he talks about the film work of Rick Moranis at this time, and it's from there that I got the fact that Honey, I Shrunk the Kids was shooting next door, much to Rick Moranis's delight, to a James Bond movie, that the James Bond movie License to Kill was in the same studio complex at the same time. There were little bits and bobs in the making of this. I mean, there's a lovely story that Marcia Strassman, who plays the character Diane Ozelinski, got a note from Jeffrey Katzenberg when Katzenberg saw the early daily footage coming through from the movie. And that note just asked her to change her hair colour, that it was reddish brown. It was described, I'm grateful to Mental Floss for flagging this one out, it was reddish brown in the early footage and changed to blonde. And so, as she would tell the Philadelphia Inquirer, Well, she questioned this with Katzenberg. She just said, we've been shooting for 2 weeks and my hair's been that colour. And Katzenberg just replied that, well, no one will notice. And do you know what? True to form, no one noticed. He was right. And that's if you look closely, that's why she's got two different hair colours in the film. Jo Johnston was deploying an assortment of practical techniques as well. I mean, a lot of this was heavily storyboarded. They were using lots of scale work as well. There was miniatures in there. And he was using the practical effects of just forcing the perspective of the camera a little bit just to get some degree of scale over. That you got the fact that the young performers in the movie are supposed to be tiny. And a lot of the props that they're working with are huge. And so they were using all sorts of almost old-fashioned techniques to bring that across. The shoot wrapped up in July of 1988. That after 6 months, they went back to LA to edit this one and go through what was a sizable amount of post-production time to pull all this together. The practical cost of the film had amounted to around $18 million. I mean, this really was a frugal production when you look at what they managed to do with it. But nonetheless, there was a year now, just shy of a year, to get it into some kind of shape for a release. Now, there were still challenges. I mean, the opening credits for a start were a challenge on this one. There's a lovely website called Art of the Title where they go through the opening title sequences of movies. And one of the things with Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, and there are a few films around at the time that were doing this, it had an animated opening sequence. But also what I didn't know was it's quite a groundbreaking animated opening sequence. And it's one of the first pieces of animation for a Hollywood movie that would combine hand-drawn animation with 3D models as well. And one of the people who worked on that was a filmmaker by the name of Andrew Stanton, who would go on to be part of the Pixar story, directing the likes of Finding Nemo and so many huge films for Pixar. The title was then changing as well. It was no longer The Backyard. They just went with a line of dialogue in the film. That's where Honey, I Shrunk the Kids came from. And I mean, Moranis found that really quite funny. The idea that the title of the film was, as Nick DeSemlin describes, on the nose. And Moranis was quoted as saying, the title says it all, really. That's the era we live in. Three men and a baby. You knew what the movie was about. Ninotchka, what was that? An eggplant dish or something? Gone with the Wind, Story of a Kite. And he was just, he just was completely tickled by the fact that this was one, it was almost like the cliched Ron Seal movie title. You know exactly what you're going to get by what it's called. The film then was coming together in time for its release now that was on June the 23rd of 1989. The initial reviews for the movie, they made note of the fact that this was quite special effects driven still. But nonetheless, they were praising of the fact that there was a lot of charm in the characters, the young performers in particular as well. They were cited for special praise. And there was generally a feeling that this was a really sweet, exciting adventure movie, and a very Disney one as well, when you consider where this started from, that this was proper family entertainment. It should be noted that the late, great James Horner contributed a terrific score. I mean, I'm a huge, huge fan of James Horner's music, and it's notable that the full score to this film didn't come out for it's a decade or two after the release of the movie itself. It took really some time to do so. But one of the things with regards to the release of this one is Disney, I mean, it suspected it might have a hit on its hands, but it also mitigated things a little bit, because what it had done, it had announced a few years before that it was resurrecting animated short films, the idea of putting a short movie with some of its feature releases. And of course, there'd been a huge hit for the studio by the name of Who Framed Roger Rabbit? It's a film I'm coming to soon on the podcast. And so this was the first time in a long time it was going to package a short movie with one of its feature releases. And it chose the first Roger Rabbit spin-off. Just a 6-7 minute animated movie by the name of Tummy Trouble. And it was very, very upfront about the way it promoted this. I remember when Honey, I Shrunk the Kids came to the UK and the Roger Rabbit element of the poster, you're getting a Roger Rabbit film with this, it wasn't a small box just down at the bottom. You knew what you were going to get when you walked in. And in fact, as the New York Times reported around the same time, at this point, within the next 2 years, it wrote, Disney expects to run two more 6.5 to 7 minute shorts featuring the accident-prone rabbit and three featurettes that will star Mickey, Donald and friends. And it's said at that point Disney's goal is eventually to pair cartoons with almost all of its live-action films. Now, that would be a trend that would trickle out fairly quickly as it would happen, although Pixar would bring it back on most of its releases, ultimately pairing the short animated movies with its feature releases. But that was the turning point there in the mid-1980s. It's kind of pottered around a little bit since and run out of steam, but there's occasionally still that intent of just promoting short movies with the longer films. Now, one person who was sneaking in to see the film, it's worth noting, was Rick Moranis. That he would pop in to see an audience reaction at matinees of his films. He wanted to see how his films played with an audience, and he was able, he wasn't a huge movie star at this stage, and so he could just slip in to see these films and not really be noticed. And when he went to see Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, he was thrilled with the way people were reacting to it. When it was put in front of an audience, this film was just knocking it out of the park and was becoming a really sizable success. However, it goes back to as well when it was programmed to be released, because the film landed in the US the weekend of June the 23rd to the 25th. It was up against Batman. Now, Batman, which I've not come to on the podcast yet, but will do, this was the Tim Burton 1989 movie that redefined the level of success a blockbuster movie could do in its opening weekend. It was the first film to ever gross over $40 million at the opening, in its opening weekend in America, grossing $40.489 million, and it opened at number one. Now, the thing with Batman, it did that in just over 2,000 screens, and as such, I mean, that's half what you get for a release now. As such, lots of screenings were selling out, and so people were going in to see another film. Well, what was the other big release that week? Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And it was reported in the Los Angeles Times around the time of the movie's release that Honey, I Shrunk the Kids was getting the overflow of people who couldn't get in to see Batman who wanted to see something else. Now, so Honey, I Shrunk the Kids opened with 14.2 million. Interestingly, the week before, Ghostbusters 2 had opened. There's Rick Moranis again. That was down to number three. Look at the other films that were about: Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Dead Poets Society, Star Trek V, Field of Dreams, Roadhouse. These were the films that were making up the top 10 when the movie was released. But Disney had released Honey, I Shrunk the Kids at just the right time. The Karate Kid Part 3 came out the week after. It held that off with a drop of just 8% of its business, another $13 million the following week. Lethal Weapon 2 came out the week after that. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids still holding on in third place. Then License to Kill came out and it held that off as well. And in fact, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids would be in the top five at the US box office for well over a month after its original release. Now, what Katzenberg admitted that was, as much they thought that they were going to have a success, they didn't quite realise just how big it was going to be. As he told the Los Angeles Times, he said, "Our tracking showed that there was awareness of the film out there, but there was nothing to make us think it would do what it did. As such, Disney wanted a sequel and wanted a sequel relatively quickly to this one. And thus, into development went the first follow-up, Honey, I Blew Up the Kid." Now, one of the ramifications of the successive Honey, I Shrunk the Kids was it gave Joe Johnston more choice over what his next project was going to be. And this was said to be the film that greased the wheels of him being able to direct his next movie, The Rocketeer. Again, I've covered that one before. I love The Rocketeer. It also meant that he wouldn't be around to direct Honey, I Blew Up the Kid. And instead, the job of that went to Randall Kleiser, the director of Grease, came in to do that one. Disney too has, I mean, it turned it into a theme park ride, and it did a straight to video sequel in 97 called Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves. And that one brought Rick Moranis back, but he was the only returnee really by the time it got to the third film. And in fact, that would be the movie where Moranis would step away from live action action acting. It's only in recent times he started to come out, 20 odd years later, that there was a TV series that followed at the end of the 1990s. In fact, Stuart Gordon was able to come back and direct an episode of that. And it's worth noting, Stuart Gordon's very praising of what Joe Johnston ultimately did with the film. Now, bringing the story right up to date, in early 2018 came the news that another sequel to the film was coming by the name of Shrunk, that would follow the character of Wayne Szalinski's son, Nick, to be played by Josh Gad. Joe Johnston was said to be returning to direct that one. And it's worth noting, it wasn't just The Rocketeer that was the aftermath of this film for Johnston. He would go on to do things like Jumanji. He would do Jurassic Park 3. He would do the first Captain America film. And Rick Moranis will reportedly come out of retirement to play Wayne Szalinski one last time in Shrunk, if and when that finally gets going. For now, though, I mean, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, I mean, it just became something of a cultural touch point at the time, not least for its on-the-nose title. If you do revisit the film, though, what a charming blend of practical effects and adventure it is, and a real reminder, as if we need it, of just how good Rick Moranis is at leading a movie. Which brings me to the halfway point of this, the 199th episode of the Film Stories podcast. For a 100% independent nerdy man sitting in a room, I sort of pinch myself at that. But I also know the reason I've got here is people like you, the people who have helped word of mouth of this podcast, who've subscribed to it, have left ideally hugely positive reviews as well. If you wouldn't mind doing that and keep pushing for me, I hugely appreciate it. And the fact that I'm able to do this, to do the print magazines that I've been able to do the Blu-ray of Sneakers we're able to do, is because people supported what I was trying to put out into the world. And I hugely, hugely, hugely appreciate that. I don't have a marketing budget or anything that luxurious. It's me in a room. I should also point out, just because I'm terrible at plugging things usually, the new issue of Film Stories magazine is nearly done. It's nearly at the printers. This is, I mean, you can buy back copies of all of the magazines at store.filmstories.co.uk. The new issue is leading on loads and loads of stuff about the film Everybody's Talking About Jamie, but there's an abundance of movie mayhem and stuff in there as well. And so store.filmstories.co.uk if you want to order yourself a copy of that. And again, thank you very, very, very much for doing so. But without further ado, I'm going to move on to the second of the two films I'm talking about in this episode of Film Stories. Slight contrast, this one. Let's go to 2010. I'll play you a clip. Come to the story, the other side of this.
My people are having a problem with this fanatic, Garza.
So you want Garza gone?
I want him dead.
All he takes is a little army. Only an idiot would do this job.
How much?
No, like I said, I'm busy anyway, so give this job to my friend here. He loves playing in the jungle, right?
Right. That's right.
Hey, why don't we have dinner?
Sure, when?
In 1,000 years.
Too soon.
This is a problem.
He wants to be president.
That then was a clip from 2010's The Expendables. Let's do a deep breath. Directed by Sylvester Stallone, screenplay by David Callahan and Sylvester Stallone, story by David Callahan. The cast: Sylvester Stallone, Jason Statham, Jet Li, Dolph Lundgren, Eric Roberts, Randy Couture, Steve Austin, David Zayas, Charisma Carpenter, Gary Daniels, Terry Crews, Mickey Rourke. I mean, pretty much the entire contents of the 1980s video shelves were in this film. However, that's not really how The Expendables started, because the story of this one goes back to 2005, 5 years before the movie's ultimate release, with a writer by the name of David Callahan, who had a loose deal going with Warner Brothers that he would write scripts, studio would look at them and see if there was anything there. Now, at this stage, he'd had a produced movie, the Doom film, remember that, with Dwayne Johnson, and he came up with the idea for something more ensemble-driven, a film at that stage by the name of Barrow. Now, Barrow would involve a ton of mercenaries, it would be an action film, and it duly went into Warner Brothers, and through basically the labyrinthine way movie studios work, it got to the desk of Sylvester Stallone. And Sylvester Stallone was interested, to the point where he fancied doing a project like this, and where he would use what Callahan had done just as basically the basic foundation for it, but would go off and do his own thing with it. So he was interested. And also crucially at that point, he was just on the verge of another resurgence. So in the, he'd had a resurgence in what, the early 90s, the likes of Cliffhanger and Demolition Man. But by say 2000, I mean, the Get Carter movie hadn't done well. Avenging Angelo a year or two later didn't do well. Detox didn't do well. But it was the revival of Rocky Balboa that really turned things back for him. That movie was done, I mean, it was done pretty much low budget. In 2006, there wasn't a huge Hollywood appetite at that time for effectively Rocky VI. But Stallone drove that one through, and the reviews were really quite strong for it. And also, it was a commercial success. That then paved the way for the Creed movies and a further Oscar nomination for Stallone. But crucially, it gave him the cachet and basically the commercial currency to get projects back off the ground. Now, he'd been interested in doing something ensemble-driven for some time. And, at this stage, he was also resurrecting Rambo, who would also have another box office outing and success. And further sequels to both of those films would carry on. But he said, I mean, there's a terrific making of documentary of The Expendables released with certain Blu-ray copies of the movie. And he talked in there about he couldn't have made Rocky Balboa 10 years before he ultimately did, because he had to go through an assortment of stuff for first before he could get to it, to be in a position as a human being to make that film. And he felt the same, really, with The Expendables. However, off the back of Rocky Balboa and Rambo doing well, this was the project he zeroed in on, and he got to work putting the script together. Avi Lerner came in as producer, the funding came together. And here was a chance for Stallone, basically, to get large parts of a gang together. He wanted, when it came to the casting of this film, as he continued to work on the script, he wanted people who were stars in their own right. He wanted to put them together, and he wanted to see what happened next. And so some of the earliest through the... I mean, Jason Statham was one of the earliest through the door, for instance. He'd wanted to work with Statham. Statham was a huge fan of Stallone. And so the beginnings of an ensemble were coming together, and gradually the phone calls kept coming in. I mean, I got to talk to Dolph Lundgren around the time of the film's release, and Lundgren's in there reuniting with Stallone for the first time since Rocky IV, and he said he just got in touch, said he's got this script that he wrote, and it's a script with a character in it for me. And I said, of course, to me that was just like a bit of a dream, because for me I was like, am I ever going to work with Sly again? And Lundgren told me, I was aware that Statham, I believe Jet Li, was about to sign, and then he signed on the dotted line, said everyone else came in later, and he was watching, as most of us on the outside were, with wide eyes as the ensemble for The Expendables came together. Basically, if you suggested an action star of the 80s and 90s, he was likely to have been on Stallone's wish list. The people then who were coming through the door, I mean, in the end, I read the full cast list out just before. There were people like Randy Couture. There were people like Stone Cold Steve Austin. But also there was a whole bunch of people who weren't in this one as well, because Wesley Snipes was going to... I mean, he was at least sounded out about appearing in it. He was going through legal problems that wouldn't allow him to leave the US at that stage, and a large chunk of The Expendables was going to be filmed in Brazil. Forrest Whitaker, he came in at one stage. He then had to drop out due to scheduling. Jean-Claude Van Damme was offered a role in the movie, but he wasn't happy with the character that he was offered and the path of the character, and so he turned that one down. It's said to be a decision he ultimately regretted, to the point where, spoiler, he would then be in the sequel instead. Steven Seagal, I mean, the offer went into Steven Seagal. There's a character. But Seagal was not a fan of Avi Lerner, and that was said to be the reason that he turned the film down. So that didn't just cost Steven Seagal a place in the movie, but also his stunt double must have been gutted at not being able to walk along a street on his behalf again. Scott Adkins was said to have been offered a role in this one. Again, he wouldn't come in till the follow-up. Mickey Rourke, meanwhile, well, he came in at almost return. Well, it was returning a favour to Stallone. He was quite candid about this in interviews, that Mickey Rourke was in a slightly better position than the last time he'd worked with Sly, which was 2000's Get Carter. Now, Get Carter is not a good nor a successful film, but at a point where no one was hiring Mickey Rourke, Stallone got in touch and offered him a good role in that. And Rourke has always been grateful grateful for that and was keen to repay the kindness that he thinks Stallone had shown. Now, Stallone also was talking through the midst of all of this in his take on the script, and he said a lot of guys have muscles, but he said, I think it's important to show a fragile side, and he wanted to show vulnerability, and so in came Charisma Carpenter's character in the film, and he wrote an extra scene for Statham with her, just to try and puncture the elements of action with a little bit of human stuff in between. I'll leave it to you to decide whether he was ultimately successful with that. Meanwhile, the movie press, of which I was a part at this stage, was delighting as more and more casting announcements were coming in, even as Stallone kept working and kept working on the script. And it became clear that by early 2009, this was going to happen. Lionsgate was coming in to do back the movie and distribute the film. And that just left the question of a couple of Stallone's old chums, really. Would they appear in it? Those old chums were Arnold Schwarzenegger, who at this stage hadn't appeared in a film for, about half a decade due to his commitments as governor of California. And then there was Bruce Willis as well. He'd not worked with Stallone on a movie. And the trio had partnered infamously in the Planet Hollywood chain of restaurants. And in the 80s and 90s, they were seen together opening all these burger joints, effectively. But they'd never appeared on screen before. And Stallone wanted them in for The Expendables. Well, they weren't able to do sizable roles in the movie. But for no charge at all, they both agreed to shoot a cameo. They wouldn't be there for long, but how's that for rounding out the ensemble? Some of the biggest action stars of all time, including headliners of huge blockbusters, were now on board. So going back to that behind the scenes documentary, that shows, I mean, there's a bit in that actually dated April 2009, just before production began, that a stunt plane test flight was taking place. And you see, I mean, this was in Brazil. You see that it's watched by a huge crowd who are there to see Stallone. And the stunt plane test flight is great. I mean, I'd argue almost it's better than what you see in the actual movie. But Stallone was, he's quite self-deprecating of the fandom that had turned out to see him. He says, they're not here for me, really. They're here for the image of Rocky and Rambo that's over 30 years has travelled the globe. And I mean, he's in some kind of awe at the fact that there's a third generation, really, of fandom that was turning out to watch all this being put together. Filming began in earnest, though, on 6th of April 2009. Again, primarily in Brazil. There was some American work in it as well. But straight from the off, I mean, going to Dolph Lundgren again, he said, Stallone, he leads from the front. He trains hard. He does his own stunts. He gets injured all the time. And boy, am I coming to that. He's not going to send his double in to do hardly anything. And Lundgren admits that kind of raised the bar for everyone else. Just like everybody feels the same way and you're going to suffer. That's part of the game. It was a tough shoot. I also asked Lundgren questions like, do they stare each other out on set? Do they have arm wrestling conversations? But he just said, no, if anything, it was only in the gym. Really, there was a little bit of pushing each other there. Lundgren also said that Stallone kept reworking the script throughout filming, but also, I mean, the injuries were piling up fairly quickly. I mean, there's footage in the documentary of Statham having to hold ice against his hand after a particularly active gun firing session. And Stallone also talked about the tight production cycle on the movie. That originally, I mean, this wasn't going to be massively cheap. This wasn't an indie movie per se. And The Expendables was coming in originally, before the full cast came together, with, I think about 60 million, something like that, was the budget that was being touted. But that budget was creeping up and creeping up and creeping up. In fact, by the time it was released, the price was said to be somewhere close to the $80 million mark. Now, that production cycle, you know, he was setting up multiple cameras for multiple shots, and he talks extensively about wanting to capture the energy of the performances, and that's why he scattered so many cameras around his set. He wanted to get the setups done so his actors really could do their stuff and do it as physically as possible. Now, there are a lot of effect shots in The Expendables, more than there originally intended to be. But conversely, the idea was do as much physically on camera as possible. Now, that included bringing together for, I think it was only for 6 hours in the end, Schwarzenegger and Willis. And Willis would say in the scene that he, Stallone and Schwarzenegger share, that we've been rehearsing for this scene for the last 20 years. They had hours to get it in the can. And Willis and Schwarzenegger did it as a favour. That there had been talk about Schwarzenegger having a bigger role, but this was basically all he could spare. They even thought, I mean, even when you go into the documentary, they're talking about, I don't think this will happen again, although Stallone and Schwarzenegger would go on to work together again, and Stallone would be less complimentary about ultimately working with Bruce Willis on stuff. It wasn't just Stallone and Schwarzenegger who... It wasn't just Willis and Schwarzenegger who flew in and out of this one. Mickey Rourke was making Iron Man 2, so he only had a 48-hour window, really, to shoot his stuff. So he came in to do that and then quickly had to go. But Stallone also was keen to make sure that everyone sort of felt a part of this film. And he told a story of being on his earliest movie, Farewell My Lovely, of being a small part in that film and being treated badly on it, how the producer was particularly rude to him, to the point where he wasn't even going to be allowed to have any lunch because they just decided he wasn't going to be there that afternoon. And he said that really stuck with him, to the point where he says, on my set, everybody gets a hamburger. Now, he was battling back against just some cultural changes in the way that filming was done, because he wanted to change the way that lunch was done on the set, for instance, that to shorten the shooting day, he wanted lunch to be brought to the crew, to the Brazilian crew, rather than them break for an hour, so they could keep working through, have their lunch, but also finish a bit earlier. And he concedes that he didn't quite understand how badly that had gone over. Nonetheless, the shoot continued. I mean, MMA fighters in the area, they volunteered to join the film and give it further authenticity as well, just to the violence. In fact, Stallone tells a lovely story about he'd only worked with wrestlers once before, appreciating MMA and wrestling aren't quite the same thing. And he said he worked with Hulk Hogan and this was on Rocky 3, and he talked of it as being like a building landing on top of him. And he talked about how in wrestling you can't fake gravity. It's the one thing that you can't do. There were lots and lots and lots of practical things going on. There were lots of explosives. There were boxes of blood being brought to the set. There were 50 stunt performers on one particular sequence. There were hundreds of extras. And Stallone would admit this was a taxing and arduous shoot. But also he'd say that it's the taxing and arduous ones that tended to work out the best. He said, I didn't bleed at all during the making of Rhinestone or Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, implying they didn't particularly turn out that well. He left some room in the midst of it all so that his actors could ad-lib, and he would continue to do the rewriting. And he talked about how he knew in the editing, I mean, this he directed before, he knew in the editing if he shot the coverage and allowed people the space, he'd be able to find the right pieces to get it all together. And he describes how I work well with chaos. He felt that the making of The Expendables was a little bit back to the way that he originally made Rocky, the way that he wrote it and tried just to kind of piece it all together. He did have some high-profile talent, or go on to be high-profile talent, behind the scenes on this one, though. I mean, there's one of the stunt team was a man called Chad Stahelski, who he talked about trying to mix American style of fighting with Hong Kong style of fighting. He's gone on to make a film called John Wick. Wonder what happened to that one. But in the midst of all the shooting, the injuries were mounting up, and very much at the forefront of that was Stallone, who at this stage, he was entering his seventh decade at this point. And in the end on this film, he picked up 10, 12, 14 injuries. And you see part of that in the documentary, that he got to a point where, with the shoot still ongoing, he goes in to have a scan done, and he's told by his physician that he's got an injury that's going to take a month to heal. All the while this film was up against its tight production schedule, and he's offered the chance of, you can take an injection and try and get through it, but really I should be sending you home to recover. And so then we see footage of a massive needle going into Sylvester Stallone's leg, which is as joyous as you would expect such footage to be if you don't like the idea of massive needles and massive needles going into Sylvester Stallone's leg. There was strong recommendation that this shut down because, I mean, Stallone was front and center of it. It wasn't just the fact that an actor needed a break. It was on his shoulders. He still worked on the script. He was directing the film and he knew he couldn't shut it down. I mean, you then see him planning the final battle scene and the cardboard model to explain it all to the cast and crew. But he was up against anxiety. He got a dislocated shoulder, shingles, a torn rotator cuff, and basically the whole throughout the back end of the production, Stallone was said to be in constant pain just through the physical challenge of making this film. And in fact, the film wrapped up in, it was July of 2009, and that was a good year before it was coming out. But it was only after that that he would have scans that would discover that his spinal cord had been compromised. He had to have a plate put in his back. But also, as the editing was getting underway, there were plans for a sequel already. There was a feeling, and not least by the massive press reaction just to the mere existence of the project, there was a feeling that there might be another one in this one. And apparently sequel talk was going on in early 2010, with the film not even due in cinemas till August 2010. It was still a bit of a race of time to race against time just to fit everything in. I mean, Brian Tyler did the score for it, and the story is that Stallone didn't get to hear the score until it was fully completed on this one. There's a weird thing on the DVD extras as well, where Harry Knowles keeps popping up for reasons I don't quite get. But Stallone on those extras talks through the first cut of The Expendables and just not liking it at all. But then he drew the parallel with the first cut of his Rambo debut, First Blood. And he talked about how he felt the first cut of that movie was so bad that he offered to buy the negative and burn it. And instead, what happened was he was given permission to re-edit it. And when he re-edited it, he took a lot of footage out. But also pretty much all of Rambo's dialogue from that film was cut out at that stage. And what he learned from that process was he never quite knew what he had until he got a film into the editing room. Now, one person who also had interest in the editing room was producer Avi Lerner. And he was, I mean, this was the era where Hollywood was enamoured with PG-13, that a few years before we'd had a PG-13 Die Hard film, which at one stage and was sacrilege and really should have been sacrilege. Liam Neeson's Taken sequels were coming out with PG-13 ratings when really that's not the kind of films they were. So what Lerner was keen to do is to see if a PG-13 Expendables would work, that two different cuts of the movie were put together and tried, the R-rated version, the PG-13 rated version. Now, in this particular instance, it was the R-rated version that got the nod. But you might recall that when the third Expendables movie came round, the PG-13 cut was the one that was released, and it went down like particularly poor flatulence in a particularly tight car. Now, the film had originally been set for release in April of 2010, but it was the fact that it was running so close to the wire that time was bought so that it could be released in August of that year. And when the film landed in front of critics, well, most of them didn't really like it. I have to say, I went to see the film, I think it was a day or two before it came out. I had an absolute hoot. I think it's one of those films that stands up the first time you watch it. If you watch it again, it dilutes a little bit. But the sheer novelty of having all of these people together in one film, well, I really enjoyed that and had an awful lot of fun with it. Conversely, a lot of critics didn't. They were criticising it for the reasons I think people were seeing it. It's all old school and it's just lots of violence and not an awful lot of character and there's loads of guns. And I think there's a general consensus, even amongst the people who really liked the movie, that it wasn't quite what it could have been. But still, here was a movie with ageing action stars on the whole headlining it, and it hit. It opened in the US in an August release slot at the weekend of August the 13th to the 15th. It got its wide release and it shot straight in at number one. That it grossed $34.8 million in its opening weekend, holding off the challenge of, and again, how's this for counter programming? Eat, Pray, Love. Not a film that's widely loved, but also couldn't be much more removed from The Expendables, and that helped itself to $23 million as well. The other big release in the States that weekend was a film that wouldn't go on to do too well. That would be Scott Pilgrim versus the World. But of the three films I've just mentioned, only one of them got a 10th anniversary special release, which kind of tells you how long that stuck around. The other movies in the charts, The Other Guys had opened at number one the week before. That was down to third place. Inception was still hanging around. Despicable Me, Step Up, Dinner for Schmucks, Salt, and Cats and Dogs, The Revenge of Kitty Galore made up the top 10. But The Expendables would help itself by the time its American run was done to $103 million at the US box office and would be Stallone's biggest hit in some time. Also, because of the nature of it being such an action-driven film with recognisable action stars, it travelled overseas as well. Another $171 million bank for a total gross of $274 million. And that was before it became a big home release hit as well. The sequels would not take long to follow. The Expendables 2 would come out in August of 2012 and would outgross the first movie. The Expendables 3 came out in August of 2014 and the response to that was much lower. Down to a couple of factors, one of which was the PG-13 rating, I'd suggest. The other was the fact that it was leaked online early as well. I remember working for a website at the time and someone pitched a review, to an early review of it, and the only way they could have got hold of it was via illicit means. There was also talk for a while of a female-driven Expendables spin-off movie called The Expendables. Let's just say if you dig out the synopsis for that one, it makes kind of wincing reading, and that project has quietly been dropped. There was also talk of an Expendables TV series, but at the time this podcast is being recorded in September of 2021, The Expendables 4 is now back on. Stallone is going to go off and get injured a bit more. Jason Statham apparently going to take centre stage of it. And I mean, really, you can but conclude that no matter what is thrown at this franchise, there's a whole bunch of people in it you simply can't keep down. Which brings me to the end of this latest episode of the Film Stories podcast. Thank you so much for listening and thank you so much for your time. Just a few notices. I am live in Birmingham again. I've got a live show coming up on the 29th of September 2021 at the Midlands Arts Centre. Starts at 7:30. You can find more about that on the Film Stories website at filmstories.co.uk. And also issue 28 of Film Stories magazine, heading to the printers imminently. And that is available at store.filmstories.co.uk. If I've not bored you to death already, you can find more of my witterings on Twitter at Simon Brew. You can support this podcast and get stuff early at patreon.com/Simon Brew. Facebook.com/Film Stories Online, YouTube.com/Film Stories. The Film Stories website, meanwhile, every weekday updated with news, features, movie mayhem, all sorts of bits and bobs there. Thank you so much for the support of that. And then the aforementioned store is at store.filmstories.co.uk. Most important thing, as always, though, is that you all take care and look after yourselves. I'm going to be back next time with a very special, to me at least, episode of Film Stories, episode 200. I've got a special guest coming along for that one. I hope to see you again or listen to you or meet you again. Don't know how it works on podcasts for that. Whether I do or not, you all take care of yourselves. You all look after yourselves. I'll be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Bye-bye.
I must break you.